Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'm your host, John Slickthelm. Here on the Aerospace Advantage, we speak with leaders in the DoD, industry, and experts to explore the intersection between strategy, operational concepts, technology, and policy when it comes to air and space power. So if you like learning about aerospace power, you're in the right place. To our regular listeners, welcome back. And if it's your first time here, thank you so much for joining us. Today, we'll be exploring the reimagination of the MQ-9 Reaper with Colonel Ryan Keeney, commander of the 49th Wing out at Holloman Air Force Base. He runs the schoolhouse that trains pilots for the F-16 and MQ-9. We also have Major General retired Larry Stutzream, the director of research for the Mitchell Institute, and Brian Clark, senior fellow and director of the Center for Defense Concepts and Technology at the Hudson Institute. And as a reminder, if you like what you're hearing today, do us a favor and follow our show. Please give us a like and leave a comment so that we can keep charting the vectors that matter to you most. The course of air power history changed on January 23, 2001, when an MQ-1 Predator, the precursor to the MQ-9 Reaper, outfitted with an inert Hellfire missile, successfully launched its missile and struck a target tank on a weapons range in California. Shortly thereafter, following the events of 9/11, the Reaper became the workhorse of air power in Afghanistan, Iraq, and other theaters around the globe. But it isn't just the remotely fired missile capability that defines the Reaper. The MQ-9 offers the right mix of intelligence, surveillance and reconnaissance, extended loiter times, low risk to airmen, and missile capabilities that combatant commanders need for their operations, especially in conflicts over the past 20 years. But how will the MQ-9 fit into the force we need in the future as the conflict changes? The Air Force is struggling to answer this question and currently plans to send the Reaper Force to the Boneyard somewhere between 2030 and 2035, with the expectation of replacing it with the MQ next. Also, it plans on offloading the Reaper's mission sets to high-end 5th-gen fighters. But the threats that we face are not going away anytime soon. In fact, they're growing, and budgets are shrinking. So can the MQ-9 adapt and fill a need for a low-cost, multi-role combat aircraft? Let's find out. All right, well, first up, I am honored to welcome Colonel Ryan Keeney, the commander of the 49th Wing, to the show. Colonel Keeney runs a schoolhouse that trains MQ-9 and F-16 pilots at Holloman Air Force Base, and he knows firsthand what the MQ-9 and the airmen behind the platform bring to our United States Air Force. So, Colonel Keeney, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Slick. Good to hear from you again. It's great to be on the podcast.
Well, I appreciate your time. I know you're a busy man, so we'll hop right into it. The MQ-9 Reaper obviously has a reputation as the go-to aircraft for operations in Afghanistan and Iraq, but for our audience, can you speak to us about what makes the MQ-9 a unique aircraft in the Air Force inventory?
Yeah, when I think about the MQ-9, and really this is remotely piloted aircraft overall, and so you'll hear me say RPAs a whole bunch, it's flexibility across multiple mission sets, which includes really capable sensors on the platform and a lot of expandable sensor suites. So that's the first one, flexibility. Second one is the ability to complete that full engagement chain. So we think about it as, we call it F2T2EA, find, fix, target, track, engage, and assess. And then the persistence to stay over target and maintain that unblinking eye. When you wrap all of those three together with extremely low cost per flight hour and the highest mission capable rate of any aircraft in the Air Force, all of that together makes an extremely capable platform that really is applicable across all kinds of military operations, across all kinds of theaters. Obviously, we've been in central command for almost our entire existence as remotely piloted aircraft air crew, but it's got applicability across the entire range.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And can you just share with us how combat-proven the Reaper is?
Yeah, so like I talked about, it's been in CENTCOM now for over 20 years. Primarily, the missions that we do there are intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. You'll hear me call it ISR. Close air support, which is engaging enemy forces that are in close contact with friendly forces on the ground. And then dynamic targeting, which you can kind of think of as counterterrorism. Across the RPA fleet, so MQ-1s and MQ-9s, we've flown almost 4.3 million hours, almost all of it is in combat. I'm going to take a guess and say north of 95% of our hours are in combat, which is more than any other aircraft in the inventory. For MQ-9s alone, that's over 2 million hours, almost exclusively in central command. So obviously a lot of combat time. And along with that, a lot of combat employment, most recently within Operation Inherent Resolve. So in Iraq and Syria, going against ISIS and their support forces, the MQ-9s were often the aircraft with the most strikes each month. In the end, it's one of the top two or three platforms, along with the F-16 and A-10, of executing the most number of strikes against ISIS. And then one of the reasons we're so highly deployed still to this day within CENTCOM is we're the most requested platform within CENTCOM. So you hear stories from the CAOC all the time that there aren't arguments about as they move fighter forces around. I mean, I think there are some arguments, but you try to move one MQ-9 from one supporting unit to another, and it turns into a fight. So it's really a combat-proven platform that we're hoping to get across all of our command.
Yeah, I was going to say, talk about a platform that is in high demand. You guys are at the top of the list. You know, just for our audience to understand, you know, the RPA community at large has gone through a lot of changes over time. And what many people may not know is that a lot of the Reaper pilots, or the majority of the Reaper pilots, will not go through undergraduate pilot training. They're dedicated to operating solely unmanned aircraft. So can you explain how the Air Force has transitioned to this type of training for the folks that fly it?
Yeah, originally it was, we took traditional pilots who had gone through undergraduate pilot training, and we either moved them over to RPAs, or we did an alpha tour where we borrowed them for essentially an assignment. But it's an entirely different training pipeline now, and it's an entirely different career field. So right now pilots are 11X. Is their Air Force specialty code, and RPA pilots are 18X. Same thing with our sensor operators. Our enlisted sensor operators are one uniform, so they're their own career field. That being said, this entirely different, separate training pipeline looks very similar to the traditional pipeline. So we essentially have four phases. We've got an airmanship phase, an undergraduate course, a graduate course, and then unit-specific mission training. So that's going to sound a lot like how you and I went through UPT. So for the airmanship course, we do something called RPA fundamentals training on the Diamond aircraft, just like we do IFT for folks going to undergraduate pilot training. So it's learning about airmanship, about how aircraft react, what does turbulence feel like, what does it feel like to be close to another aircraft or close to the ground. Then they go to Randolph Air Force Base to do URT, so undergraduate RPA training. And there's two parts to that. There's an instrument part called the RPA instrument course, and then the RPA fundamentals course. So the instrument course is so that they get an instrument rating so that they can fly through national airspace. RPA fundamentals course is it's a start of RPA kind of mission training. It's where we first pair up the pilot and the sensor operator. When they graduate from there, they get their RPA wings. After that, they go to their specific MDS for here at Holloman, as well as my associate units in Syracuse, New York, and March Air Reserve Base in California. We run them through the initial qualification training in MQ-9. It's about five and a half months long, and the URT program ahead of time is about 4 months long. So we get them through all the missions of the MQ-9, give them a check ride in that, and we send them to their combat unit, and they get their unit-specific mission training within their combat unit. One of the unique parts of this pipeline, number one, it's short pipeline. So by the time someone is commissioned to when they're flying in combat is typically a little bit less than a year, versus for me, it was a little bit over 2 years when I flew F-15Cs. And then also our mission qualification training at the units is done in combat. So you're a brand new arrive at Creech or Shaw, Whiteman, Ellsworth, and your first sortie after you leave Holloman is typically in combat, where you're still learning your missions. So that's something else that's kind of unique about our pipeline.
Yeah, there's so much that's been built out on the way in which you all train your folks. And, you know, with that, I'm hoping you can explain a little bit how you would compare the experience of the Reaper operator compared to, say, you or I, you know, the normal fighter pilot that went through the traditional pipeline. Because as I understand it, and one would think that the Reaper operator is exposed to a much broader warfighting team much earlier in their career versus folks in manned aircraft. And how does this experience between the two differentiate people behind the MQ-9 from other pilots, and also it has to flow to the maintainers and the personnel behind the platforms compared to like the F-22 or F-35 even?
Yeah. I'll give you, that's a good question. I'll give you some, at least my experience on it. So when I graduated the academy and went to pilot training, from that time until I was fully mission qualified in the F-15 was about 2.5 years. And I was fully mission qualified as a wingman, which meant, you know, stick around with lead, make popcorn and coffee, and you can be successful. In the MQ-1 and MQ-9, it's, like I said, it's about a year or a little bit less, not only until they're fully qualified, but until they are flying in combat as an aircraft and usually as a mission commander, because a lot of the ways we employ the MQ-9 is single ship downrange. So the second lieutenant and A1C who are flying that aircraft, they are responsible for the entire mission. They don't have a flight lead necessarily to lean on. Like I said earlier too, that, you know, the air crew are finishing their mission certifications in combat. So a lot of the times we'll take a little bit of training time from our lines that are flying in combat. And that's how we do our training, is while those aircraft are flying in a combat zone. And then pretty quickly after they get mission certified, they're flying combat missions. I think the quickest we've had is someone finished their mission certification check ride and were already employing weapons in combat within their first hour, which is completely different from my experience on the fighter side. On the fighter side, got to my unit, I finished mission qualification training, and it was train, 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 and hopefully you are good enough to be picked to go on the team that gets to go to combat. And hopefully your squadron gets called up. In the RPA community, you know, combat is the day that ends in Y. It is every single day, 24/7, 365. We don't lock the doors because there's always someone flying a combat mission somewhere in the world in the MQ-9 community. Like I said, you know, after 2.5 years in the Air Force, I was a wingman that went to combat. In the RPA community, a lot of the folks flying the line are second lieutenants and first lieutenants, A1Cs and senior airmen. So it is actually pretty usual to have a second lieutenant and A1C flying together that both have hundreds, if not well over 1,000 hours, almost completely in combat, and will certify second lieutenants and A1Cs as instructors, instructor pilots and instructor sensor operators. So a lot earlier exposure is one of the things. And both to combat and also mission command. And then I hit this a little bit earlier, but exposure across a whole range of mission sets, not only doing ISR, but also talking to troops on the ground, doing convoy escort, doing some air interdiction sorties in combat. I had crews that were involved in combat search and rescue missions as well. And once again, that all happens pretty early. And the final thing is RPAs are inherently linked to the space and the cyber domains. So we have, and this is one of the things I'll talk about on our maintenance side, is we actually have aircraft communication maintenance units. So they are 3 Delta, so comm troops that are under 21 series AFIs, so maintenance AFIs, because the cockpit that we fly out of is, you know, run by a whole bunch of computers. So we have comm folks to take care of that, but it's connected to an aircraft. So it has to be run under our traditional aircraft maintenance tech orders. Then it runs out through some fiber optics and we bounce the signal off of a satellite somewhere in the world. So it's really linked to those. And so early exposure there to not only what are the possibilities within the space and cyber domain, but also the vulnerabilities that are there.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. You know, the responsibility that they have at such a young age, especially in their career, is just absolutely incredible. And I know one of the best things about being a commander is being able to talk and brag on your people. But I'm really wondering, from your perspective, you know, having been a C-model guy and now being a wing commander, how are the airmen different between, you know, what you experience as a manned fighter pilot and now, you know, commanding and watching these young unmanned RPA pilots and sensor operators?
I mean, they're tech savvy, they're innovative, they're full of bold ideas, which is pretty similar to my young man pilots on the F-16 side. I think it's I'm really impressed by all the great ideas and the bold initiative I see from the young folks. I mean, I'm still a dinosaur, you know. I'm learning to program my VCR in a streaming video age. But they're one of the things I see on the MQ-9 side, and because it's connected with space and cyber, and they're all digital natives. They're kind of multi-domain as a default. So they're really tied in on the space side. They understand satellite footprints, declining satellite orbits. How do you hop across satellites and frequency hop? What are the threats there? On the cyber side, they understand encryption, comms. They understand how to figure out multiple sources and combined sources. You know, within the cockpit, not only do we have a connection to the aircraft, but we typically have a whole bunch of other connections, either to the DGS. We've got communication connections there. We've got JWICS. We've got SIPR. And so working across all those platforms, they have the ability to do that. And then things that I didn't, it took me a while until I went to FECOC for electronic combat and understanding the different bands. They get that in their initial qualification training. So on the aircraft, obviously you've got the sensor ball, which is the probably the most important part of the MQ-9 aircraft. So you've got electro-optical, so TV and infrared. Then also there's a synthetic aperture radar that we teach how to use throughout the course. But then also there's a ton of potted solutions from, you know, electronic surveillance, and electronic warfare that they understand in ways that we would not quite get. We would say they're beeps and squeaks, but they understand that at a pretty fundamental level. And one of the cool things is when you tie all that knowledge together, you know, with these kind of move out innovative and bold ideas, you can actually execute a lot of change. And one of the cool things about the MQ-9 is it's a very flexible platform, right? You can put a lot of potted solutions on there. We respond to a lot of urgent operational needs from the combat environment. And because this is in a combat environment and the combatant commander is asking for them, we can take some risks to, and there's not a man in the aircraft. We can take some risks to field combat capability really rapidly. So one of the cool things is I see young MQ-9 aircrew that have these great ideas and they can actually see them come to fruition. Whereas I was chief of F-15 test for a while, working operational test. And it was 4 or 5 years before my idea could be in a operational flight program on an aircraft. So these young aircrew are pretty cool. They come up with great ideas and they get to do things in combat for the first time, which is really neat to get to see them do that.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. And you mentioned a little bit in your comments there about looking into the future. And so I'm going to put you on the hook a little bit because, you know, we know obviously we've departed from Afghanistan, but it appears that the Reaper is still 100% in demand, as you mentioned. But what do you see happening next with the aircraft? And how do you see the next decade in the life of Airmen and the Reaper playing out?
Yeah, so I think over the next decade, you'll still see us doing what have been our traditional missions within Central Command. So whether that's ISR or counterterrorism, dynamic targeting. But the big change I think we're going to see is that we'll be moving across multiple AORs. So there's a lot of mission need for what the MQ-9 provides, both on the persistence and the flexibility across multiple missions within Indo-PACOM and UCOM specifically. But I see that there's needs within NORTHCOM and SOUTHCOM that could be filled by the MQ-9 as well. But right now, we're really looking at Indo-PACOM and UCOM. I also see that some of the technical changes we're making, we're going to be more integrated in the national airspace system, just like we are in the combat theaters. In the combat theaters, an MQ-9 is essentially treated like any other aircraft. But within the United States, we still work through the FAA. And so it's a pretty extensive process to move an MQ-9 from one place to another. But most recently, in our most recent Ace Reaper exercise, we flew an aircraft from CONUS to Hawaii for the first time. Usually when we move MQ-9s around, you box them up. So you take the wings off, you put them in a box, and you airship them somewhere else. Given the, you know, it can fly for a day and not very fast, but it can fly for a long time. You can cover a lot of mileage during that time. So I think we'll be more integrated in the national airspace system. We'll start moving these aircraft around more like we do our other aircraft. And the last thing is more agility. So you're going to see smaller and more agile force packaging. Really, I'm looking at our launch and recovery elements. We've been used to large main operating bases in, like you talked about, in Afghanistan or Iraq, throughout the Middle East. As we move into these other theaters, what we're trying to do is decrease the size of those force packages and be able to move them rapidly rather than operating out of kind of well-established multi-year main operating basis.
Yeah. Now, you know, I was going to kind of dovetail there because, you know, we were speaking about uses beyond counterterrorism and counterinsurgency missions. And at Mitchell, you know, we have a paper and we've discussed how the Reaper can be reimagined. And you all did, and I think you may have alluded to an operation called Operation Agile Reaper. Can you talk to us about what the experience was there?
Yeah, we've done three iterations of this event. So we did it in September of last year, September 2020, April of this year in 21, and then again in September of 21. And so the idea, we had a couple of different things that we're trying to get after. One is we're trying to train to the full range of missions. So we're not just training to the missions that we do in Central Command, which, like I said, is close air support, dynamic targeting, ISR. But the platform definitely has the ability to do a whole lot more, including air operations in support of military warfare, strike coordination, reconnaissance, as well as some other missions that we can do for our maritime forces. And so that was one thing. We needed to get to a training environment where we can do that. You know, there's a lot of sand around Holloman, but not a lot of water. So we wanted to go someplace where we can operate with Navy and Marine Corps. And the second thing is, like I was talking, getting to that smaller, agile footprint for our launch and recovery ops. So the first two iterations, we went out to Point Magoo Naval Air Station in California. First one, we ground shipped all of our equipment, and we wanted to see how quickly, once we got onto base, how quickly could we set up a launch and recovery, be able to catch an aircraft. So we were able to get that from weeks down to hours. The second exercise, I want to do island hopping. So we went out to Point Magoo. And then, but this time we went by C-17. So we did the same thing off of a C-17. How quickly could we set up a launch and recovery site? And then we also used C-17. So Altus was kind enough to have C-17s tag along with us. We went out to San Clemente Island and we wanted to see how quickly could we land an aircraft and essentially do a FARP. So do a refuel and simulated rearm of 8 Hellfires on an aircraft and get it back off the ground. And this last exercise this year in September, we wanted to air deploy out to Hawaii and integrate with the Navy and the Marine Corps out there, doing missions both close air support over land and amphibious assault with the Marine Corps, as well as maritime surveillance and some maritime attack with the Navy. So really cool building blocks. These are the kind of missions that I see that are necessary for the MQ-9 to fulfill in Indo-PACOM and UCOM. And to me, this was getting directly after what Jerome Brown said of accelerate, change, or lose. We need to get our forward force package as light and as rapidly deployable as possible. And the vision is that within the next year, essentially any 5,000-foot strip anywhere in the world that we have the ability to land at is we'll land an MQ-9 there and be able to turn it and get it fully refueled and rearmed and launched out within an hour.
Well, absolutely incredible. I want to, again, look at the future here. And, you know, right now it's planned for the MQ-9 to sunset around 2030 to 2035, which for guys like you and I sounds like a long time away, but it's around the corner here. So what does it mean for the airmen and the human enterprise behind the MQ-9? I would think that they're crucial to the Air Force moving further into you know, increasing the autonomous UAVs and manned-unmanned teaming platforms and things like that that we're talking about with NGAD.
Yeah, there's a lot of uncertainty here with what we're going to necessarily have as the follow-on platform for the MQ-9 for these aircrew. Like you said, there's a lot of them. The MQ-9 rated community is the largest single rated community within the Air Force. So we have more pilots than sensor operators, more on officer rated and enlisted rated than any other community. So trying to figure out where do they go? These MQ-9 aircrew, they've got exposure across all the domains. They've led missions in combat. Almost all of them have employed at some point in combat. They've honed that decision-making in that pressure cooker of combat. And to me, the multi-domain thinking, the decision-making, the ability to work command and control problems at continental distances, and the ability to think big picture are skills that we want within the Air Force. Those are essential skills. And so how do we take these multi-domain warriors that we've built and find a way for them to be utilized, have them utilize their skills in the future, whether that is in the MQ-9 platform, in the MQ Next, whatever comes after the MQ-9, or maybe in other platforms that we haven't thought about. As you said, we're still just getting to the edge of what we think we can do with autonomous, semi-autonomous, optionally manned, manned-unmanned teaming, and where do we need these RPA crews involved in that, I think is a great brainstorming session for what does the future look like for these career fields.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And I just want to say thanks so much to you for taking the time to come out and join us today on the show. We just really appreciate everything that you are doing as the wing commander there and everything going on at the 49th Wing. So thanks so much for being here today.
Thanks a lot, Slick. It was a great discussion.
So now that we know a bit more about what the MQ-9 is doing, I've got Mitchell Institute's Director of Research and author of the Reimagining the MQ-9 paper, Major General Retired Larry Stutz Stutstream. So Stutz, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks. I love what you do, Slick.
Well, thank you so much. And joining Stutz, we also have Brian Clark of the Hudson Institute. Brian, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot, Slick. Great to be here.
Stutz, now that we've heard from Colonel Keeney about what the MQ-9 and the force behind it is capable of, I want to ask you point blank, what is the thesis of your paper, and in what ways do you think we can reimagine the Reaper?
Well, Slick, first of all, the Air Force is not in great shape considering so much of its modernization plans over the past decades were canceled or delayed. And so now with the pivot to a rising China, who is closing all the advantages the Air Force once dominated, the Air Force finds itself needing to replace everything, and it comes when vastly new warfighting concepts are needed. However, you know, the Air Force is in a tightening budget box, and it's got a color in that box, so it turned to the only course of action left, and that's to cut legacy systems that can't survive in high-end conflict. It takes the money it was spending on that to finance modernization out in the future. But not all things on the Air Force's chopping block are irrelevant to the future, Slick. You know, we advocate in this paper that the Air Force reconsider retiring its sizable inventory of already paid for MQ-9s. They want to begin to retire those in 2030, and they'll all be in the boneyard by 2035. And we want the Air Force to reconsider how those MQ-9s can be beneficial to the Air Force's modernization goals. So when we think about the MQ-9, we want to help the Air Force reconsider with some points. And one of them is, hey, what is the cost for MQ-9s to perform missions in the battle space relative to other capabilities? It's maximizing a cost per effect. Look, all things are not destined to go downtown and bomb Beijing, but those same things that might not do that mission are not necessarily irrelevant. There's not a drop in demand by commanders for the MQ-9. In this ISR strike mission, it's the tool of choice, as you know, and this is going to continue. No end in sight. So if one retires the MQ-9, what's the analysis telling you? Well, we can save money by investing a little to modernize Reaper to endure longer on the timeline in a slightly increased threat environment in these low-end missions. Secondly, the value of using MQ-9s is directly related to preserving high-end aircraft, especially our fifth-generation fighters, for what they were designed to do, perform those high-end missions. The MQ-9, of course, has the lowest operating cost. It's incredibly adaptable. And we've seen across the last 20 years the grinding down of the high-end Air Force to do these low-end missions. It makes no sense. We don't want to go back to that. And then, of course, we do agree there should be a replacement down the road for the MQ-9's mission. But look, the time, cost, and risk of that, especially in the budget environment today, needs to be reconsidered. So let's think about new uses of the MQ-9 Reaper. And that's where the real imagining is pretty fun. One of the most valuable principles and strategies is to use what you have in new ways. And when I say what you have, I'm talking about the aircraft you have today, the satellites you have today, the airmen, and all the rest. Can you use it in powerfully new ways? And we maintain in the paper that you can adapt Reaper for new uses that directly relate to the high-end environment or support of that higher-end environment and other things we have to do today. So here's what we're talking about, some new uses. And these are, no kidding, requirements gaps, Slick, for which there is no budget room to address. Of course, wide area surveillance where there's strategic competition. Of course, we're not in the high-end war fighting yet, but we need to see and know what's going on. Another one, air and missile defense. This is such a serious problem, a limiting factor to U.S. military success. We've got to better defend our air bases. And the MQ-9 Reaper has already been demonstrated to be a key part of a system of systems that protects those bases. Communications relay, the future Air Force, and its information-enabled warfighting concepts need the architecture, and the Reaper could be used for that. Very low cost compared to manned aircraft today. Another one, very interesting, Arctic domain awareness. We've got the Russians with advanced cruise missiles technology, and General Van Herk at NORTHCOM has testified that there's just not enough warning time. We don't have the ability to see what's happening up in the Arctic like we should. And I combine this with North American air defense against those Russian cruise missiles. We could see a Reaper providing a web, a network of sensors that can be deployed with increasing, you know, crisis to be able to detect. And there's been demonstrations of Reapers shooting missiles, shooting down air-to-air targets. So you can add them to the firepower of the guard units that will be doing that intercept mission. Of course, defense support of civil authorities is ever more needed today. Reaper could very much help with the initial ISR that helps direct all rescue efforts and so forth. You have a vast area of maritime littoral operations. And then the Reaper is also a platform that can really reduce risk in many, many new concepts that are being developed because it's unmanned. It's easy to modify. It's cheap, low operating costs. Bottom line, there's a lot of value to reimagine. The Reaper is not merely a legacy aircraft destined for the boneyard. It is the most relevant aircraft in the Air Force inventory.
Brian, I'd like to bring you in on the conversation because Colonel Keeney spoke about a series of tests that he's running on the MQ-9 to explore their use in maritime and littoral operations. It's obvious that the mission set will be critical in a high-end fight with an adversary like China. So how do you see the MQ-9 operating in this type of operational environment?
The MQ-9, I think, has a lot of utility for high-end missions that has been overlooked in the focus on it being used in the Middle East. You know, for example, it's had a lot of demonstrations where it's been employed for anti-submarine warfare. That's a mission that the Navy has some severe gaps in terms of both capacity and in survivability, because its current platform, the P-8 or P-8 Poseidon, is a relatively large signature aircraft that has to operate in relatively permissive environments. So it's not going to be able to go up in the first island chain and do anti-submarine warfare against the Chinese. So being able to deploy sonobuoys and monitor those sonobuoy fields and even maybe attack submarines with torpedoes and depth bombs, those are jobs the MQ-9 can do. And the Marines that are going to be deploying MQ-9s in the first island chain could support that ASW mission. I'd say one other big mission that really is going to be important for the Navy is airborne early warning. The distance that the carrier is likely to have to operate from China, 1,000, 1,500 miles, means that the E-2 Delta, the Navy's current airborne early warning aircraft, isn't going to be able to see vast areas of airspace between the ships and the coastline of China or the threat environment. So getting that situational awareness and that early warning for the airborne early warning is going to be necessary. And the MQ-9, with a passive sensing array that it currently has, and then, improvements could be made to, could really give you much better situational awareness of that broad, several hundred mile gap that's going to exist between the threat and naval forces. So there's a couple of really important high-end missions that the MQ-9 could support that the Navy desperately needs to help with.
Sure. Now, are there any other ways in which the MQ-9 has proven itself in supporting maritime operations, or any other ways we could equip the MQ-9 to meet the need, either from a capability or capacity in these operations?
Absolutely. So the Marines have already started using the MQ-9, and they plan on buying a couple dozen of those aircraft over time for targeting. So surveillance and targeting is going to be a really important mission for maritime forces. Today, they tend to rely on space-based assets, which are not always going to be able to give you that close, quick kill chain in wartime as they do in peacetime because of the likely interference with space communications as well as with electromagnetic operations inside the theater like the Western Pacific. So being able to have kind of local organic fires and local organic kill chains is going to be essential. So having the MQ-9 be able to do surveillance and targeting in places like the South China Sea and in the Philippine Sea will be essential for the Navy to engage those targets, or for Marines ashore to engage those targets. We talk a lot about deterrence by detection, you know, the ability for the MQ-9 and other ISR assets to shape the adversary's behavior by putting them on notice that they're being watched. Well, that only works if the adversary knows you've got a way to close that kill chain. You know, so deterrence alone is not going to deter anybody, or rather detection alone is not going to deter anybody. Closing the kill chain is what does deter somebody. So I think that's one thing that the Navy and Marine Corps are both looking for the MQ-9 to support, is that surveillance and targeting that's necessary to close the kill chain. And one other thing I would say is that the integrated battle problems the Navy did recently, which evaluated the MQ-9 in anti-submarine warfare, as well as in surveillance and targeting, also looked at the MQ-9 as a communications relay platform. And one of the challenges that we have found in our wargaming of Pacific conflicts is that naval forces are going to have to execute mission command, where we lose the ability to manage the warfight on a theater-wide basis, and we now have to devolve command down to smaller units, so essentially carrier strike groups, amphibious ready groups, expeditionary advanced bases ashore. And those individual commanders are going to need the ability to communicate with the forces that are under their control, because they're now cut off from what's happening back at, you know, headquarters, whether it's Yokosuka or in Hawaii. MQ-9 can provide you that ability to communicate over that broad area that a commander might still have the ability to control, using line of sight communications without having to rely on long haul or space assets that might be problematic or contested inside a fight with China. So there are several ways that the MQ-9 could support the maritime mission at the high end, and that the Navy has demonstrated in some recent exercises.
So, Brian, taking your comments one step further, it is clear that the MQ-9 offers a tremendous opportunity to build out an ISR net that covers the Pacific. Looking at our allies and partners in the region, can you expand upon what using the MQ-9 for this role really means for them?
So one thing I'll say is up front, we approached our research on this, and I'm finishing up a study on maritime air power right now, starting with the operational challenges and then kind of working back to the solutions that would be best suited to support those challenges or to address those challenges. And so we found that ISR and T and targeting, airborne early warning, anti-submarine warfare were all challenges that the Navy and its allies need to address. And I think to get to your point, this is a great opportunity for Australia, for Japan to be able to expand their use of the MQ-9 to support those missions, because they don't necessarily have the wherewithal to have a robust anti-submarine warfare network or a robust ISR network, because they don't necessarily have the budgets to support, you know, large space constellations or the ability to deploy a large number of manned aircraft. But MQ-9s could give them the ability to do these high-end missions at a relatively affordable price and at a scale they would never be able to achieve within their current budget.
Now, Stutz, I want to bring it back to something you and Colonel Keeney mentioned earlier, and that is the people behind the MQ-9, the operators and the maintainers. It's clear that this is an incredibly innovative community, and it's a skill set that the Air Force and the Space Force really need. So how can we best leverage the MQ-9 community as we move into the future?
Well, let me begin, Slick, by parsing this as a warning. Do not mismanage this generation of airmen of the unmanned aircraft era. In fact, we recommend in the paper, Congress overlook, watch very carefully the handling of these airmen to protect them and not allow a transition plan for the future that disrupts or damages or forces them to vote with their feet out the door. We can't afford that. We've done deep dives at several Reaper units, you know, with names like Marauders and Ghost Warriors and Griffins. And the fact is, this is one of the most innovative communities of airmen. They have a broader understanding of the warfighting machine at a much more junior level. So as the Air Force says, it will move into increasing levels of unmanned aircraft, increasing levels of autonomy, manned and unmanned teaming. Who are the most relevant to on-ramp the Air Force to that future? So the MQ-9 generation and its airmen need to be fully integrated into many aspects of the Air Force. For example, Air Force staff and joint staff assignments, so that they have influence to better forge the way ahead. And that's not happening, even after two decades. So there's many benefits to Air Force modernization and reimagining the Reaper, but there is tremendous risk to not cultivating and protecting the irreplaceable experience and culture of these airmen. These are unique airmen, but let me tell you, they are all about fly, fight, and win. They stand toe-to-toe with any other combat aviator in any other system.
All right, we're running a little tight on time, so any parting shots?
I think it's really important to keep in mind that the MQ-9 and its evolution going forward is going to offer the ability to operate at the high end. And even if these aircraft are, potentially lost in a conflict with China, the cost that they have relative to their manned counterparts or to, even the larger unmanned systems that might be used is a fraction. And so, a $20 or $30 million MQ-9 being lost is almost on the scale of something that we could consider attritable and that we might want to use in these high threat environments rather than turning to something that we've used in the past, like an E-2 or a P-8, which are definitely not platforms we can afford to lose in combat. So the attritable nature, the scalability, and the ability to operate at the high end all make the MQ-9 something we have to consider as part of the kit for naval forces in the future.
Well, as always, Stutz, and of course, Brian, thanks so much for being here, and thanks for taking the time today to be here on the podcast.
Thanks a lot, Slick. It was great to be here and great talking with you.
Thanks, Slick.
While the story of the MQ-9 is currently planned to come to a close in the 2030s, maybe this is just the beginning. Reimagining the Reaper may provide the Air Force and other armed services with a mix of capabilities that they need to address the growing range of threats that our nation faces, and it's not just combat operations. The future of the MQ-9 may be in question, but at least one thing is for sure, if there was ever a group that could rapidly adapt to changing their mission set and innovate with a platform to meet new threats, it's the airmen behind the MQ-9. Thank you, our listeners, for your continued support. And thank you for tuning in to today's show. We've got a lot of new and exciting content coming your way, including a few lighthearted flying stories for the holidays, and also some deep dives on space capabilities to kick off the new year. We'll also be headed out to a few air and space events near you, so don't forget to follow or subscribe to our podcast, and follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn to find out where we'll be next year and what the Mitchell team has in our sight picture. And please, don't forget to leave us a rating, hit the like button, and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment to let us know what you think about our show or areas you think that we should explore further. And visit us at MitchellAerospacePower.org to get the latest reports, events, and analysis that are charting the vectors for our air and space forces. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll see you next time. Stay safe and check six.